Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
President Trump tells UN members to confront rogue nations. It's Wednesday, September 20th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We also invite you to stop by Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Myanmar's de facto leader speaks out about Rakhine conflict. Cryptocurrencies helping to pay for North Korean missiles and nukes. Japanese sand depicting U.S. history. Skipping doctor visits. Cybersecurity. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump called Tuesday for a great reawakening of independent sovereign nations, but told world leaders at the United Nations they must collectively confront the rogue countries of North Korea, Iran, and Venezuela. He told the opening session of the UN General Assembly that the United States will, quote, have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea if it is forced to defend itself and American allies from a Pyongyang nuclear or ballistic missile attack.
Now North Korea's reckless pursuit of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles threatens the entire world with unthinkable loss of human life. It is an outrage that some nations would not only trade with such a regime, but would arm, supply, and financially support a country that imperils the world with nuclear conflict.
And for the first time, Mr. Trump condemned North Korea's human rights record, including its prison camp network, as he urged nations to join in greater action against Pyongyang.
No one has shown more contempt for other nations and for the well-being of their own people than the depraved regime in North Korea. It is responsible for the starvation deaths of millions of North Koreans and for the imprisonment, torture, killing, and oppression of countless more.
The U.S. leader mocked North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for pursuing a dangerous path.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about.
Trump also derided Iran, saying its leaders had turned a wealthy nation into an economically depleted rogue state that undermines peace in the Middle East with its military adventures. And he described the regime of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro as corrupt and said Maduro had brought the South American nation to the brink of total collapse. In all, there are 90 heads of state, 5 vice presidents, 39 heads of government, 3 deputy prime ministers, and 52 ministers attending the annual UN conclave in New York. Rand Corporation defense analyst Bruce Bennett tells VOA, the tough part of global strategy is making a judgment on North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's escalation threshold.
Kim has said that if even one artillery shell is fired at North Korea, he's going to level Seoul. Now, Kim may be bluffing on some of that, and maybe that's what Secretary Mattis is counting on. But that's been the pretty strong statement by North Korea in the recent days. It's hard to tell what Kim Jong-un's escalation threshold is. How desperate is he? He seems to have shown a fair degree of paranoia in killing his older brother this year, in carrying out a whole series of significant escalations in his provocation series over the last couple of months. This suggests that he's feeling some real threats to his regime survival. And in that kind of case, it's very difficult to tell. He may be prepared to escalate, even against an embargo or something like that.
Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis says the United States so far has seen no need to shoot down any of North Korea's missiles. But Bruce Bennett says the 2 overflights of Japan's northern Hokkaido island have caused some tension.
Well, one would think that those would be less than some of the other kinds of military actions. Shooting down a North Korean missile is taking away a capability that, in Secretary Mattis's terms, was threatening Japan. Secretary Mattis has said that he's prepared to do it if the North Koreans fire something at Japan. That's just purely a right of self-defense that the Japanese would have and we as their allies would have.
Secretary of Defense Mattis warned of a different response should North Korean missiles directly threaten the United States or its allies like Japan. Bruce Bennett said from what he has learned from defectors, sanctions are hurting North Korea, but not enough to impact its nuclear or missile programs. He said China appears to be increasingly obliged to enforce existing sanctions, not wanting to be seen as enabling Pyongyang to evade sanctions enforcement. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. UN chief says millions live under shadow of DPRK nuclear threat. Many disappointed in Aung San Suu Kyi's speech on Rohingya crisis. Probe into state firms reveals nagging corruption problem in Vietnam. Jet fuel shortage disrupts travel to and from New Zealand's main airport. Seattle honors Cambodian refugees' affordable housing campaign. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are always found on Facebook at VOA Asia, and we also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Myanmar State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, under international criticism over her government's silence about the security crackdown in Western Rakhine State, told the people of Myanmar, also known as Burma, that she does not fear global scrutiny and is committed to a sustainable solution to the conflict.
It is not the intention of the Myanmar government to apportion blame or to abnegate responsibility. We condemn all human rights violations and unlawful violence. We are committed to the restoration of peace, stability, and rule of law throughout the state. Human rights violations and all other acts that impair stability and harmony and undermine the rule of law will be addressed in accordance with strict norms of justice. We feel deeply for the suffering of all the people who have been caught up in the conflict. Those who have had to flee their homes are many. Not just Muslims and Rakhines, but also small minority groups such as the Dine, Maro, Tep, Miramaji, and Hindus, of whose presence most of the world is totally unaware.
In a televised address Tuesday, the Nobel laureate, whose National League for Democracy has been in government for 18 months, defended the country's rights record and said that resolving the sectarian dispute, decades in the making, will take time. She expressed concern over the exodus of hundreds of thousands of Muslims to Bangladesh following insurgent attacks August 25th against security forces that prompted a crackdown that has allegedly burned villages and left hundreds dead. She said her government is offering safety and aid in hopes that they will return and take part in a verification process leading to citizenship. In Myanmar's largest city, Yangon, independent analyst Richard Horsey tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Aung San Suu Kyi had to balance international concerns about the plight of the Rohingya with nationalist sentiments among the country's majority Buddhists.
Well, I think the content of the speech demonstrated very clearly how fine a line she feels she has to tread between what really are diametrically opposed views between the majority of people in Myanmar and much of the international community.
The UN has called what amounts to ethnic cleansing as far as the crackdown that has forced hundreds of thousands of Muslim Rohingya to flee to Bangladesh.
That was not covered in detail in Aung San Suu Kyi's speech. She stated that the facts had to be determined, that there were allegations and counter-allegations. So she has not stated clearly her view or the government's view on who is responsible for the exodus of refugees to Bangladesh.
Did you get the sense that perhaps the refugees can return, perhaps they'll deal with the issue of citizenship down the road?
Well, I think the most specific commitment in the speech was that the government was prepared at any time for a repatriation of refugees from Bangladesh under the terms of an April 1992 agreement between the two countries. That was following a previous exodus of a quarter of a million people in 1991-92. It was a very specific commitment. But of course, the time for repatriation is some way down the track. We're currently still in the midst of the crisis, and large numbers of people continue to flee to Bangladesh. It will only be after the conditions are created in Rakhine State for an orderly, safe, dignified return and people were voluntarily willing to come back, the provisions of that agreement could be put in place.
Richard, as you know, of course, there are strong feelings, nationalist feelings, sectarian feelings among majority Buddhists about the presence of the Rohingya Muslims. Is reconciliation possible?
I think it's incredibly difficult, and clearly the attacks of the 25th of August have made it many times more difficult to envision a future where the communities are living integrated again, peacefully side by side. That is many years down the road, and it will take an awful lot of work by the government and across society to achieve that. The space for reconciliation, the space for steps that would allow this population to live with rights, recognition, freedoms, dignity are far away at the moment.
Richard Horsey said whether the more than 400,000 Rohingya return to Myanmar depends on the arrangements agreed to between Myanmar and Bangladesh, involvement of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and conditions on the ground in Rakhine State. Happening now in Asia, India says it has intelligence of links between Rohingya refugees and Pakistan-backed militants inside India, as it justifies plans to deport about 40,000 refugees who entered the country in the past 5 years. India has come under scathing criticism from UN officials and rights groups for its plans to expel the illegal immigrants. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. As the North Korean government sees sanctions against it pile up in the wake of its continued missile and nuclear testing, there's a report saying that Pyongyang is trying to find new and different ways to fund its continued military expansion. The report says North Korean hackers are targeting cryptocurrency exchanges. The author of that report is Luke McNamara, senior cyber threat intelligence analyst at FireEye Incorporated. It's a global cybersecurity company. He spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
We have seen in the last year an increase of sanctions from the international community targeting North Korea. And I think that's, you know, forced them to be a little bit more creative about how they raise funds and bring in hard cash. In this particular case, they have a very adept cyber espionage capability, and I think they've pivoted to use that for financial gain. And then the other, you know, larger macroeconomic driver in this case is that cryptocurrencies have appreciated significantly in value this year, which has made them a very attractive target just as a financial asset. So both of those really are driving the particular cyber threat activity that we've observed.
Luke, for the uninitiated, and that might be me as well, I fear I got to ask you some basic questions about the cryptocurrencies, specifically Bitcoin. What is it, and how is it that a country can use it as currency?
So Bitcoin is essentially digitalized and decentralized giant ledger that records a list of transactions that people make over time. And there's nodes across the entire world run from different computers or different electronic devices that take a record of all those transactions. And that's essentially what makes up something called the blockchain, which is the technology underpinning Bitcoin. And people can use it, and when they make these transactions, they can use these transactions as a form of payment. So it exists as a giant payment network in some respects.
Well, it sounds like all this is being traced. How is it that this apparently has not been traced back to North Korea except for you?
This report that we put out is observing a cluster of activity done by a group that we call Temp Hermit. We believe this group is linked to North Korean actors, cyber espionage actors. We've observed them in the past. Target things that are of interest to the North Korean state. And lately, over the last year or so, we've seen them go increasingly after global financial targets. Last year, we saw a lot of traditional financial sector targets like banks and payment processors being targeted. And what this report really focuses on is this year we've seen a pivot to include something called cryptocurrency exchanges. These are essentially places where these cryptocurrencies are bought and sold and traded and swapped for a variety of different cryptocurrencies or even fiat cash. So these exchanges are a very centralized place that if you want to steal Bitcoin, they're one of the best targets to go after, because these are places where people are, you know, doing a lot of trading and buying and selling these exchanges. So you could either compromise the back end of the exchange and steal it from the exchange itself, or, you know, conduct more targeted attacks if you know who the customers are using these exchanges.
Where are these exchanges that you say have been hit located?
Right. So in the particular group of activity that we've been observing, the targeting has focused on cryptocurrency exchanges in South Korea. And South Korea is really one of the countries that is leading the growth of trading volume in a variety of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum. We've seen a tremendous amount of growth in the price of these cryptocurrencies this year, since the beginning of this year. And there's really been an expansion in Asia in particular of the trading of these cryptocurrencies, South Korea being a big part of that.
Luke McNamara, Senior Cyber Threat Intelligence Analyst at FireEye Incorporated. Luke, thanks so much for being with us.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. As many as three dozen domestic and international flights at New Zealand's Auckland Airport have been canceled as it struggles to deal with a week-long fuel shortage. New Zealand's main airport has lost 70% of its jet fuel supplies since a digger ruptured the main pipeline that carries fuel to the facility. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As we continue now with VOA Asia, the Tottori sand dunes on Japan's west coast attract some 2 million visitors a year, and many come to see the huge sand sculptures created for an annual exhibit hosted by the Tottori Sand Museum. It's the world's first indoor sand museum. With the recurring theme of touring the world in sand, previous exhibitions featured iconic images from Africa, Southeast Asia, Italy, and Russia, among other locales. But this year, for its 10th exhibit, Tottori had sand artists explore American history and culture. VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us how in this report, narrated by Faith Lapidus.
19 international sand sculptors, five of whom were from the U.S., spent 2 weeks turning 3,000 tons of sand and water into American icons. There are scenes from the East Coast and the West, and parts in between. Scenes depict the nation's past, its future, and its present.
Well, when I first saw the Trump sculpture, I was glad that it was there, because it's important the fact that the Trump sculpture is reflecting modern history at the moment.
The sculpture of President Trump was added 2 months after the exhibition opened in April to fully represent the sweep of America's history, according to museum director Takeshi Shimazawa.
By starting from the history of the United States, such as the Civil War and the Declaration of Independence, to this sand sculpture of U.S. President Donald Trump in this observation deck, we express that everything from the past to today is one page in the U.S. history and connected to each other.
The president was not everyone's favorite sculpture.
I'm not a fan of Trump, so I wasn't exactly thrilled by it, but I am happy to see the rest of the exhibit, and I can admire the detail and the craftsmanship of the artist.
That craftsmanship made a lesson about American history and culture fun.
Through sand art, I enjoyed the history of the U.S. These sculptures are wonderful, and I can't believe they will collapse.
Crafted from hard-packed sand, they are very durable. The sculptures will be on display until January and will be removed before they crumble. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Aung San Suu Kyi's first speech on the weeks-old Rohingya crisis in Myanmar was a nationally televised event many hoped would signal a new direction or perhaps an inspiring attempt to mend the conflict. Many observers, though, say the address may have obscured the more serious allegations against the country's military. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, we might all be grateful to see routine visits to the doctor's office a thing of the past. Faith Lapidus returns to tell us about a new device developed by an Israeli startup that may at least help reduce doctor visits.
Say ah or hi to Taito, a device that allows patients to conduct a physical checkup from home.
We basically replicate a face-to-face interaction with a remote clinician while allowing him to do a full physical examination, analysis, and diagnosis of a patient at home.
The Taito app, using algorithms and visual recognition technologies, guides patients through the exam, measuring vital signs as well as more complicated procedures.
So basically the app is like my doctor helping me to do the exam. So let's do another example of the ears. So I'm connecting the otoscope.
Telemedicine is a growing trend in the health industry, using new technologies to improve service for patients and cut costs for insurers. Taito was tested at Schneider Children's Medical Center in Petah Tikva, Israel, to compare its accuracy and quality to traditional checkups.
What we found was really remarkable, that there was almost no difference between the two types of examinations.
But even supporters recognize telemedicine's limitations, aware that certain diseases and complaints require an in-person visit to the doctor's office. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Reports of cyber attacks against companies and governments around the world seem to be appearing in the headlines more frequently this year. Cybersecurity experts explain why the risk of being hacked is now greater, as VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details on who is doing the hacking and what can be done to prevent or minimize the damage.
From the power grid to major corporations, no one anywhere in the world is immune to cyber attacks, and the problem is growing.
The internet is becoming more and more integrated into our lives every single day. And we as citizens and we as corporations and governments are becoming more interconnected. This means that there's increased attack surface for those who wish to be malicious.
More dependence and digital information on the web means greater financial gain for criminals. In the last year, there has been an increase in cases of ransomware.
It's becoming easier and easier in part because the toolkits needed to break into many of these systems are becoming more readily accessible on the dark web.
Tracking down the criminals is not easy.
Reporting cyber intrusions is underreported to law enforcement, whether it's the FBI, Secret Service, or another entity.
Federal and state laws on reporting breaches are vague.
Much of what happens in the case of businesses is they don't necessarily know what information has been disclosed. And they sort of perhaps intentionally lay a blind eye to that to say, well, we don't know that personal identifiable information has been disclosed. All that we know is someone got into our system.
The FBI says the people doing the hacking range from criminals who want money to hackers with geopolitical motivations.
Clearly, there are nation states that are involved in cyber activity who are interested in stealing our trade secrets, our proprietary information that our companies are developing, our secrets within our government.
So it's not a matter of if an attack will happen, but when. The FBI says building partnerships is critical so there can be a plan before an attack occurs. Another way to prepare is to rethink how systems on the web are designed.
Understand that individuals are going to get in, but make sure that the structure of the systems are designed to contain the damage that can occur.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
No need to hack us to hear our program. You can find VOA Asia all over the internet, on iTunes and SoundCloud, also at the voanews.com website, and visit us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Our friends in Myanmar are listening via Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thanks so much for joining us today. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.